We hear a lot of perspectives on the Mankind podcast. Inclusion of a guest is not an endorsement of their views, and the opinions expressed here do not always represent the mission or values of the Mankind Project USA.
Looks like the rain has gone.
Kevin, mate, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you here, mate. I found you through Talent Smart, and in my research around kind of emotional intelligence and my deep dive into the work, your profile popped up. And as I looked into your history and your past, I just knew I had to get you on. So thank you for taking the time all the way from the sunny UK, huh?
Absolutely. Well, thanks for having me, Brandon. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Yeah, absolutely. So, mate, you spent 7 years in the British Army, in kind of the 80s and to the early 90s. And in our previous conversations, you were sharing how culturally the environment you were raised in as a young man, how that impacted you. And we'll tie this to emotional intelligence and how this relates to today. But to give us a little bit of an insight of what it was like to be a young man getting involved in a very serious profession.
Yeah, I think it spans back before then. I'm from a military family. My great-grandfather was in the military, my grandfather, and then my father. My father was an airborne soldier in the British Army. My claim to fame is I was born in Hereford in the UK because my dad served with the Special Air Service for around 5 years. So he was at the top of his game in terms of, you know, being a top soldier. And I guess my dad was always my hero. He was a very strict man, but you could see that he got on with other men. He could form relationships. Guys liked him. He was fit. He was funny. He was handsome, and he was a good guy to hang around. And I guess I looked up to him. And you know, the only thing I ever wanted to be growing up was a soldier, really. One, for the travel, and two, for the adventure. I think those were the main things. And certainly that was my dad's life. And I mean, when I look back now, it's a little bit of a selfish life for a married man with 6 children, which was my dad. He was going all over the world doing stuff. But my mum, bless her, probably deserved the medals rather than him, because she would have to cart us around and home us and get us to school and all the rest of it. But yeah, I joined the army at 16, and I joined the Royal Engineers because my father wanted me to have a trade. Originally, I wanted to join the infantry because that's where the excitement is in terms of combat and all that stuff. But it was a good move joining the Royal Engineers because they gave you a trade, and it was more of a thinking man's soldier. So, yeah, joined at 16. It was quite brutal in the early 80s. You know, the British Army had just won at the Falklands in 82, so it wasn't too long after. So the Army was still living off that, and rightly so. They did really well. But it was a really hard culture. So I was classed as a junior leader, a boy soldier back then. But immediately it was quite tough for me, because back in the 80s, certainly in England, racism was rife. And you know, don't get me wrong, I haven't got any hard feelings about that. It's just how it was. But I was the only sort of dark-skinned recruit. And I stood out quite soon, and I didn't think it would really matter, but it did. And so all through my teenage years, I had to apply another filter with my emotions to fit in. And that's difficult because I'm Maltese by heritage. My mother and father are Maltese, and we weren't living in Malta, so I didn't have my culture, so I didn't belong there, and I lived in the UK. And really, although I was born here, I don't look English, and I didn't really belong here. So from very early on, I had to work out what my narrative was as a person, And sometimes you can't be yourself because you're always trying to second guess what people are thinking and saying. And that affects the way you behave. It affects the way perhaps you respond to people. And I struggled with that as a young man, particularly in the army, because they say what they feel, and it's quite brutal in terms of, you know, people will punch you or they'll say things that are really unkind. And I certainly had my fair share of that. But what I found is that when people got to know me, they'd say, actually, and their prejudices would break down. And actually, I made some great lifelong friends. So don't get me wrong, I wasn't a victim in the army, but it was clear that I was slightly different, which meant that I really had to perform well to stay in. Right. So I was very fit. I enjoyed being a soldier. My reports were good. And you know, I got promoted in the army, which is great. It's super. But it was extremely difficult because in the army, they talk about emotion suppression. Mm. And if you think about your life now, me as an older man, I understand how important it is through emotional intelligence to actually make space for your emotions. Even if you're doing a really serious job, there are ways of managing those circumstances with emotional intelligence. And I just realized how I was finding my way with little bits of emotional intelligence, although I didn't know it at the time. But my life could have been a lot easier if I had had parents that had nurtured me and shown me how to not only express my emotions, but also to learn about how to manage other people's feelings and emotions. And sadly, as a lot of people of my generation, we didn't have that.
No, culturally, it wasn't. I mean, it just wasn't the thing. I mean, your parents were directly impacted by their parents because they're Depression era, right? Mm-hmm. So, and especially coming from Malta, there's been a lot of things that would have impacted the way in which your parents would have been raised when they were born. And from the men and women that I've interviewed on the show that have served, they've often shared that it was very easy for those who committed cruel acts in the military to justify them with this excuse of, do you think the enemy cares about your feelings? Do you think they're going to care about them and take care of them and all the rest? And they shared that in the moment, it's easy to go, okay, well, I guess that makes sense. You can draw a line there. But on the same token, it just chips away. Those experiences just continue to chip away. It makes me think of like Full Metal Jacket, where the dude just gets punished to the point where he snaps.
Yeah.
And how much of that did you witness? It sounds like you were able to, you know, ingratiate yourself to others and build those connections. But did you witness others that couldn't handle that heat?
Yeah, there were some really weird characters in the army. I consider myself relatively grounded, and you know, I was quite steady. I was responsible. I was sensible. I'd been brought up with moral standards. You know, my dad told me honesty is the best policy and all of that sort of stuff. And I valued that upbringing. But I have to say, in the army, there were some strange fish. There were some people with some, yeah, it's this thing about killing, I guess, and some deep psychological issues. There were other people that drink was the drug of choice in the army, and people used to get extremely inebriated, and then there was usually violence that followed. And I'm just so thankful that that wasn't me. I like to drink, but I didn't. I certainly wasn't that way inclined. But I started to look and think that at some stage, I thought, I don't know if I fit in here because I want to be a soldier, but I don't want to be a drunkard, and I don't want to be a fighter. I want to be professional. And what actually happens a lot of the time is you stand out, and sometimes you stand alone. And that can be difficult. Right. Yeah, especially when you look different and you want to fit in.
Yes.
You know, but I'm glad to say I didn't really get involved in that. And in the 80s, my camp was in all the UK tabloids for extreme cases of bullying. I'm talking like extreme. One guy went to prison for it because it was like extreme bullying. Wow. And torture. And living in a culture like that, although I didn't subscribe to it, I felt that some of that was starting to impact me. I told you when we had our pre-chat that, and some viewers may be able to relate to this, some may not. Whilst I was in the army, I had a bit of a spiritual experience. And, Brandon, nobody, because like my dad, I was quite headstrong. Nobody could preach to me or tell me about God, and they didn't. But I had a bit of an epiphany moment from one of the Padre's services, because we had to go on a Sunday in the army. And it really stuck with me. And I started on a journey without anybody knowing, because I was embarrassed, thinking about God and what was this all about? You know, what if there was a God? How would that affect how I led my life? Because to be honest with you, what I was seeing in the army was hardcore male behavior that wasn't really an example of what I wanted to be like. Mm-hmm. And so becoming a Christian gave me a moral compass, but also, again, it's hard for people to understand if they haven't had a faith experience, but it gave me the power for living. And it gave me a direction in how to live my life and how to have the power to do that. And that brought on a whole new dynamic, because apart from looking foreign, you've now got this guy with a faith. And, before I'd swear every other word and, I was just a typical British soldier. And now all of a sudden there was this transformation, which is change from the inside out, that had occurred. But do you know what happened? It started to heal my emotions. And stuff started to come out in me that made me think, do you know what? I'm actually okay in my skin. One, if people don't accept me. And two, if my behavior isn't conducive with theirs. I was happy to be unpopular and to stand alone in that. And I had a certain amount of emotional strength, because it was more about I needed to be me. And what's very interesting, I'll end this part on that, is that one by one, the guys started to say, what is this about this faith in Jesus that you've got? And one by one, they started to come to church, and we got nicknamed the God Squad. But we were really good soldiers. We were fit. We were strong. We were keen. Yeah. So it wasn't the stereotypical image of somebody that needed a crutch to lean on in terms of my faith. So my faith really was a turning point. And I know that might turn some people off, but all is what I can say to you is, a man that's now 56 years old and having had some really hairy situations in life. You know, I've seen combat. I went out to the first Gulf War. I think it's Desert Storm to you people, but it's Operation Granby to the British Army. And that was an interesting situation. And then following my police career. So I'm not a naive person that needs a system in my life to give me meaning. This was the real deal. I can only say that my faith is intrinsic and is the thread that holds me together. And in terms of emotional intelligence, I explain it that above that you've got spiritual intelligence, because to Christians, the soul is the mind, the emotions and the intellect. It's made up of those. It's who we are. You know, our bodies are flesh and blood, but inside us of who we are, that bit that we can't put the finger on, you can't see, is our soul. And so for me, the emotions are so important, because they're part of our soul as well, which is the deepest core of who we are.
Hey, Boyson.
Brandon, what's happening, man?
Mate, I'll tell you, little one, my daughter, she is becoming more and more her. Bindi, which is amazing. I'm just eating it up. But when I don't want to eat it up is in the middle of the night, 4 in the morning, when she's trying to skip naps and I've got a lot of things to do. That's when things get a little tough.
So what are you leaning on? I mean, yeah, right. I get that. How much coffee are you drinking these days?
Well, mate, you know me. I'm certainly not. I don't like the vices. You know, I've been in the health space for a while, and I get a little bit too hooked on those things. So I'm pretty grateful that we had the folks at Magic Mind reach out to provide us and the audience some value with their Magic Mind drink solution. And dude, I can tell you, it is blowing my mind.
What's it doing for you? I'll talk about mine, but what's it doing for you?
Well, mate, I think the biggest thing is sustained energy. That's what I need. I need to have the same energy at 10 a.m. as I do need at 2 p.m. But when the energy dips and I've still got work to do and she's crawling all over me, screaming in my ear, that is when I need to be able to push through. And yeah, so I'm not getting the dips. And unlike coffee, I'm sleeping at night, which is amazing.
Yes, the ingredient thing. So that's me too. I've been a coffee dude for a very long time. And when I get into these spaces where I'm just working, and I get too much into the coffee, I end up like frazzled and stomach achy and jittery. And what I'm seeing with Magic Mind is like, I've reduced the amount of coffee I'm actually drinking in the morning, and Magic Mind boosts the focus for me. So for me, it's like, how many things can I juggle in a day? And having that focus without the coffee stuff, without all the coffee downside, I think has been really good for me. And yes, the sleep thing, man, there's some ingredients in this stuff that have totally helped my sleep.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I mean, because you're getting the caffeine from matcha, which is an extended release caffeine as opposed to like an intense rise then dip. It's got all the fancy mushrooms that you know everyone's taking these days, including ashwagandha, which gives you that más fuerte kind of energy. And and fortunately for us, they've offered us a great discount that us and you, the listeners, have access to get 56% off your first subscription and 20% off a one-time purchase with the unique discount code MANKIND. So if you go to magicmind.com/mankind, you get access to this discount. And like us, you get to enjoy this sustained energy, that más fuerte energy. I can take that into a couple places. But yeah, big fans.
And do, yes. Check it out, yes.
Yeah, and I need to get my wife to stop stealing mine, which would be great.
Thanks, Brandon.
What the modern soldier looks like now. You're absolutely right. I can remember being, we just liberated Kuwait, and we were going along the road, and there were kids on the side of the road. They were eating cigarettes. They didn't have any food, and they were clearly happy that we had liberated them. We saw all of these vehicles going through with Union Jack flags, and you know, we'd liberated the country. But we were throwing food down, and it's the very core of who we are as people. You're absolutely right, because a lot of the military stuff is, it's hearts and minds. We're there to build relationships, and we know, don't we, from emotional intelligence. Not only have you got to have that social awareness of what's going on here. What's the vibe here? What's the need? What are people displaying around me? And how can I bridge that if possible? And then you've got the side of building relationships that are cultural. I mean, we had some training, and it's quite interesting because the extent of the training back then was, don't look at any of the Bedouins, and don't look at their watch, because if you look at their watch, they'll want to give it you. Because it can be an insult. And you know, if you stay in their camps, don't stay longer than 24 hours. They were giving us these lessons, which were great. You know, they were very interesting. But I have to say, although, you know, I've given you one or two examples of, you know, sort of extreme behavior, there clearly are some very good communicators in the army. And in order to have those open-handed gestures, that sincerity, because we need to forge links, we need to make allies. It's so, so important. And as I understand it, particularly in the British Army now, there's a Ranger unit that has only recently been formed up. And they're seen just below Special Forces, I think, but they have a specialist role. The selection criteria for them is to be tested on their levels of emotional intelligence. which I find fascinating.
Wow.
So it's starting to filter through. And interestingly, I said to you before you started the show that I've recently been speaking to the British Army about emotional intelligence, and they are very, very keen now to take the program on. So we're now exploring how that might look. And they're even looking at young men, because the retention rate of under 20s is extremely low. Have real issues with leaving home into an environment that is quite strange for them.
Yes.
But interestingly enough, the highest levels of mental health issues are between 20 and 24 with young British soldiers, which, and they've got the highest suicide rate between the RAF, the Navy, and the Army. The Army has, and to be fair to the Army, they're saying these are the issues they've got to grapple with, you know, retention and recruitment. Mm-hmm. And they're starting to become alive to the fact that younger people are far more emotionally aware, I believe, not only through experience, but through what I've read. In order to engage with those emotions, it can't be cardboardy. They have to understand the landscape that these young people are operating in to build their resilience, but also to connect with them in a way that they'll get the best out of them. The command and control way is the Army. But I think as times change with the way that the younger generation are coming through, they're recognising that emotional intelligence skills are key. And for the Ranger unit to be selected on that emotional intelligence.
See, that's something that's very interesting to me, because that was a humongous challenge for a lot of leadership. I know during the Vietnam War, is you had leadership that had experienced the Second World War, they had experienced Korea, and then all of a sudden they have these kids coming in with long hair and, hey man, and, you know, wanted to get high all the time. Obviously not, it wasn't every young person that got drafted or brought in, but there was a real challenge with organizing and galvanizing these soldiers, because there was just a huge dissonance, in essence, of expectation of what was the task at hand. And we saw that play out in the US's ineffectiveness over in Vietnam and eventually losing the conflict. I'm not saying that was exactly why, it was a lose-lose situation from the jump. However, a lot of these commanding officers and a lot of the upper leadership were not able to connect with these kids at all. So is that kind of like what you're saying today, is that there is this generational shift? There are those who, from your generation that went through, had a different experience culturally outside of the military than what young people are today presenting with?
100%. So in my day, it was crack on.
Yeah. Tablespoon of cement. Keep going.
You just got to keep going, and you're not going to give up. And there's this part of that that actually is great. But what about if I preface it with this? Okay, we're going to have to crack on. That's the objective. We're going to think about how we feel now, very briefly. Right, we're going to talk that out, but then we've got to go through. And at the other end, we're going to have a debrief. And we're going to make sure that we've talked through all of the issues that you might have around that. But for now, that is the objective, okay? And that's where we've got to go. So I actually think that, you know, if we train our young men to go through, if you like, a routine of, right, something difficult's coming up, quick bit of self-talk. I know that in 30 minutes, this is going to be over. But what I've got to draw on now is X, Y, and Z. And if I do that, you know, it's the if and then. If I do that, then that's going to happen. And at the end, we're going to talk about that, and we're going to make sure that it's debriefed so that the next time we get the learning and we understand where our strengths were in that. And also the areas of development. Yeah. So there's a way of doing it. You can still be tough. We're not asking them to be soft and to sit down and talk about it for an hour. The job's got to get done.
And we're not debating the outcome. We're not debating the objective. It's like, no, you're not going to change what we're about to do. It's just your feelings are valid, and we're not going to leave you behind emotionally once it's done.
Absolutely right. Yeah. And I think it can be woven into objectives, missions, very, very easily. It's just the army have to find their style. You know, it's time critical and it's a disciplined organization. And I celebrate that. I learned so much in the army, so much great stuff that I'm so grateful for. And, you know, I made a decision as I became more emotionally intelligent of the bits that I wanted to leave behind. And I didn't want to help shape me and form me. Sadly, I still have army mates that still have those bits, and it's caused them problems as they've entered civilian life, you know. So we all make choices, don't we? And there are consequences with those. But being emotionally intelligent has been a game changer for me, because I literally now have a system that I go through that is actually habit forming, that is just part of how I make decisions. You know, every decision has an emotion attached to it, Brandon. Every decision has an emotion attached to it, okay? So for us to say, no, I'm a man and I just go, no, you're deluding yourself. Every decision has an emotion attached to it. So isn't it important that we understand our emotions and actually are precise about the emotions that we're feeling and that we want to take us through to that decision or through that experience? Mm-hmm. When you become highly emotionally intelligent, it's not just angry, sad, happy. There's a whole plethora of emotions that you can select that are like finely tuned to take you through and to equip you best for each situation.
Hmm. What do you mean by that? How does that look in practice?
Yeah. So, for example, rather than saying happy, I could be content. Rather than being sad, I could be disappointed. You know, rather than being angry, right, I could be frustrated. Gotcha. So we've got to be far more accurate.
That's a lot of men, right? Because anger is socially an acceptable emotion. And I can go, well, that pisses me off, when the truth, if I do some digging, is that actually that outward expression of anger is a shield that's hiding fear. Fear that I'm socially not allowed to share, because if I share that I'm fearful, then I'm less of a man, based on how I was raised on the playground or in my household or in my rugby team or whatever.
Yeah.
And got it. So it's basically doing the work and having the self-awareness, which of course is the first step for many as they go into their emotional intelligence journey, being aware of, you know, where am I feeling, what environments, what situations, what people trigger certain emotions. So not only did you have your time in the military, you then transitioned into another line of service, which was 25 years in the police force. And so I imagine culturally there may have been some degrees of separation, but attitude wise, I'm sure. Well, I don't want to assume culturally, how did the police force differ much as far as the attitudes of how to deal with emotions?
Completely different organization. Remembering it was in the 90s now, so it was still old school, because there's some research to show that police officers are more emotionally intelligent than the general public, okay? And that's because of the situations that they have had to deal with. They're like a wild salmon. They've had to find their way through it and to cope with it. They've got it. And now they, every incident they go to, I can remember how I dealt with that one. And actually I need to show some empathy here, or actually what they need here is some direction, and I'm the cop and I've got to provide that. So I need to be strong. And you start to form it, but it doesn't come without a cost, because a lot of the time officers get assaulted despite being empathetic or showing a high degree of emotional intelligence. You're dealing with an unknown quantity on the other end. That said, I have to say that unless somebody's got severe mental health and they're not in their right mind, most of the time the emotional intelligence skills and behaviors that we learn really navigate you through, because it's all about slowing everything down. Slowing everything down. And incidentally, I face more danger in the police than I did in the army. On a day-to-day level, you might go to 40 incidents on a tour of duty, and there'd be some real dangerous ones in there. People that at their wit's end, aren't thinking straight, are wielding an axe or whatever. So you know, the danger, you had to be far more on your game because you didn't have a rifle that you're pointing at somebody as you were in the army. This was more about, you know, we're the only, I think we're probably the only police service in the world that aren't routinely armed. You know, So we haven't got loads of kit on our belt. We certainly didn't have in the 90s. Mm. And we didn't even have protective vests. We just had shirts. Wow. So it was really about having great comm skills. We used to call it conflict resolution. And, you know, interestingly, Brandon, you had some cops that were great. They'd be sent to certain jobs because they had a smooth tongue. They were great listeners. Mm. They were emotionally intelligent. There were others that were the same officers time and again that got assaulted. And it said something to me that clearly their skills weren't as finely honed, because it always ended, unfortunately, in a fight and somebody getting hurt. And it would transpire that they didn't have the communication skills that perhaps the more adept officers had.
Right. Yeah. So the ability to de-escalate or diffuse a situation, and that interestingly makes sense that cops with their lived experience, you know, they have to hold multiple perspectives at one time. They're not just a hammer trying to find a nail to stop a situation. They have to look at multiple things occurring at one time. And, you know, they may not be diving into motive just yet. Generally, I imagine that's after the fact, but it's trying to de-escalate a situation. You've got multiple personalities. You don't have a lot of data when you arrive on scene, and you have to quickly form relationships and understanding, right? And read a situation, which in essence, 50% of emotional intelligence is understanding and interpreting what's happening out there, right? In your relationships, in a room.
It does, but I think as well, Brandon, it starts before that. It starts when the job comes through your earpiece and you're getting in the car, wondering what you're going to face. That's the time when you do some self-talk with your colleague. You say, right, how are we going to handle this? Well, if it's this, we've got option A. If it's this, we've got option B. Do you want me to be the first one to go out and to talk and to listen? Yeah, you can do that. And what I used to love doing is I used to love summarizing. So I'd read back what they'd said. So I'd say, so if I understand you right, what you're saying is X, Y, Z. That's how you understand the situation. Is that right? Yeah. We know, don't we? One, it shows I've listened. And two, it shows I've heard and understood what they're saying.
Yes.
That in itself was a great bridge to then understanding what's happening. And it's really difficult sometimes to stay objective and to think, I think I know what's happened, but I really have to listen.
Right.
And it really tests your emotional intelligence skills when you're listening to somebody that's angry, that hasn't got the skill to communicate their emotion. You're always on a knife edge of violence, always. And it's a real coup when you can talk somebody through listening, empathizing, mirroring, and really showing them that you want to understand. And also being aware of all of the other people around, that social awareness, is there danger elsewhere? Yeah, it's just an absolute minefield. But it is so great, because as a cop, it wasn't about arresting people. I actually saw it as a victory if we could get them to stand down, to look, to think, and actually to if you like, for my sensibility to be infectious, that they'd go, all right. And to just bring it down. Because what we're dealing with, in effect, is the brokenness of humanity. That's what it is. And that's never good to see. It's sad. But I have to say, although towards the end of my career, I sort of got trained up in emotional intelligence. Before, I was just winging it. I was just doing what I thought a good person would do. What I thought was an ethical and honourable way to act despite their situations. Don't get me wrong, I'd wrestle with the best of them and I'd arrest people, absolutely, to keep people safe. But I also wanted to understand, but a lot of the time, even with me being relatively switched on about it all, I'd go home at night, Brandon, and my three girls would be in bed. My wife would have gone to bed, and I was supposed to get in at 10:30 at night from a 2:10 shift. And I'd get in at about 11:30, 11:45 because we'd been held over for incidents because it was so busy. Mm. And I didn't know about self-talk. I didn't know about breathing. I didn't know about, you know, just visualizing things and letting them leave me. What I did is I opened a bottle of red wine and I sat in a dark room. I didn't even put the lights on. And I just drank, I must have drank about 2 or 3 glasses of wine just to come down. And then I saw all of these scenarios in my head. And then I had the fear of, did I, because it's a job where you're extremely accountable. Did I do that? Did I do that? Did I make sure that piece of paper went in? So you had the afterburn of the job as well. And if colleagues were injured or there was a particularly gnarly accident or a death, you had all of that building up. And do you want to know something? Where did it go? Just put it in a box. Just put it in a box. Yeah.
Hit it. Repressed it, denied it, and shoved it down, and that and always comes back, right?
The root of it, my kids, because I'd be a snappy father. They'd be wanting to talk about small nothings, and I'd be thinking, hey, you know what I've been through? And slowly you become detached, and people can't relate to it. You know, my wife didn't know half of what I did because I didn't want to, I guess, sort of infect her with all of the rubbish, the crap that I'd have to deal with, you know. And it builds up, and you know, you've got cops with all sorts of issues, and now it's coming home to roost. Mental health and well-being in the police is just there's an epidemic, you know. And the police are looking at ways that they can sort that out. But you have all of these traumatic incidents, loads of them out. Yeah. You know, people with their head, you know, going to road traffic collisions and seeing a car full of people with bones sticking out and them all moaning and then having to go. And the next job is going to a suicide and having to tell the wife that the husband hung himself in the garage. It's just... Mm-hmm. One after the other. And part of it is you do get desensitized. I just started to see death and just thought, it's one of those, isn't it? It's sad, but hey, you know, I've got to survive this.
That's something that you, when you bring that up, it reminds me of a conversation I had with Greg Campbell, who you work with closely, and his experience in law enforcement. How, you know, as a young 20-something, he was like, give me the homicide. Like, give me the homicide. I can handle it. I can take it. I can just shove it down. And when he goes home, it'd be like, where's the remote? Turn on the TV. Wall it off is the language that he used. But inevitably, that it always comes up. It always comes up and comes back, that those experiences, those adverse experiences that don't get processed in a healthy way. And what you were saying, how you would approach a mission or an objective today with your emotional intelligence skills is, this is the objective. We have to handle this car wreck, or we have to handle this, you know, suicide, and we're going to debrief after. And from what you're sharing, there wasn't that opportunity, or at least that encouragement culturally, to debrief those emotions and those experiences. It was just go home and pretend to be like nothing happened, and go to the kids' dance recital as if you didn't just pronounce, you know, find 4 people dead.
Yeah, I agree. And at that time, I didn't know what the answer was. But what happens is your threshold to stress, as you build up all of those incidents, it's not long before you have an outburst, because it's like, don't you know what I've just dealt with? You know, and that's not only colleague to colleague, that's family, and family often get the brunt of it. And taking it a step further, you know, the amount of times as an inspector I had members of the public complaining about 1 or 2 of my people, and I'd say, I'm really sorry that you felt that way about the way the officer dealt with you, but he'd just dealt with a multiple fatal RTA. Road traffic accident. So when he came to you, he probably hadn't processed that, and I'm really sorry about that. And that member of the public would say, I didn't think I'm really sorry, actually. I hadn't thought about it. And we say, look, we don't go out to be nasty. We join this dog to serve and protect. But that particular officer had just dealt with a really bad incident. And so, you know,
it's that which is unseen, right? You're bringing to the surface that which is unseen, and it gives multiple people the opportunity to change their perspective and shift their perspective. And it sounds like this member of the public was able to give grace to that officer and perhaps just let it go with that awareness and that understanding of, wow, I didn't know
100%.
That this person I interfaced with went through such a horrific thing.
And you know, the public, they're not going to know that. They're not mind readers, but it's having an appreciation of the job that we do. I'll tell you this incident that shows that that shows how things can change. My wife was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2011, and she had to have a double mastectomy. And when she had the double mastectomy, my mum had literally, I found out about my wife's diagnosis when I was sitting in the hospice with my mother, who was passing away. So it's a double whammy, right? And we've got three children. Yeah. They were very young. And it was stage 4 aggressive cancer, right? And I went out on duty that night. And there's no way I should have been out on duty, but I did. And there was a big disorder in the town, and there were people fighting, and all of my officers were out dealing with this fight, this disorder. And I had to go to the scene because I was the inspector in charge of the area. And I just went to see if they'd got it handled, if there's anything I could do to help. And these three lads started to shadow box around me. And I was at the limit. Think about the news I've just had. Think about what I was dealing with. And despite being relatively emotionally intelligent, these kids just didn't stop. The CCTV showed me open-handed gestures, "Please, guys, get in the taxi. There's a load of trouble here. You don't need to be here." And they started to fiddle around trying to take my CS gas off my belt and trying to get my baton. So I thought, I've got to do something. So I dragged the one down to arrest him. And then some of my troops could see that the boss was in a fight. So they came to help me. When I got up off the floor with this guy, the CCTV showed me knocking him with my foot as if to say, next time, don't mess me around. And I nudged him with my foot out of the way. That was classed as an assault. I was then being investigated. I was told by my barrister, you may lose your job for this. I was thinking, my wife is lying in bed having had a double mastectomy. My mum has now died, and I might be losing my job. And not only that, in the UK, because it's an assault, you could have a criminal record because you nudged this guy with your foot. And that taught me a lot. It taught me a lot about, I didn't realise how stressed I was. And he's fortunate that I just nudged him in my foot, because the way I was feeling, I just wanted my head to explode. Sure. My wife had stage 4 cancer. I was probably going to lose her. And as it happened, you know, I did lose my wife to cancer. But it showed me that even if you're emotionally intelligent, if you remain in a situation that is going to overspill with trauma, confrontation, extreme stress, it might not cut it if you've got nowhere to go. And I felt at that stage of the game, because I was actually struggling and fighting with this guy. Maybe if my wife was well and my mother hadn't died, I would have got up and said, right, put him in the van, and I would have just walked away. But your levels of tolerance and your emotional intelligence sometimes don't line up. And in an extreme situation like that, don't get me wrong, I think, you know, to be emotionally intelligent in a situation like that, if you could pause, breathe, move away, you'd be extremely good. That'd be the way to be. But with all of those pressures in the real world, that didn't happen with me. But it compounded the issues, and that was a tremendously stressful 12 months. Thankfully, I didn't lose my job. I was still left the force having received my good conduct medal because it was an isolated incident and in the circumstances. And even the guy that complained said, well, didn't know all of that had happened to him. But yet again, that's no excuse. The public deserve better. But I let myself down because of circumstances. And, you know, I'll tell you something now. During that time that I was being investigated, I used to walk in the woods looking for a tree that could hold my weight. That's how bad it got. And it's interesting how men default to that. If we feel like we're failures, we've lost our respect, you just think...
unworthy.
Do you know what? But do you know the one thing that stopped me, truthfully? Because I have no problem in dying. It was more about my children and my wife. If she's battling cancer and I throw my life away, what are the ethics there? And then my faith angle, I didn't want to do that. And my children being fatherless and wondering why I ever did take my life. So, you know, there were some really deep lessons there and some real soul searching. And interestingly enough, there's two things I do when I'm under immense stress. I exercise and I pray. I exercise and I pray. And you know, some that aren't religious might say, yeah, that's a good way of self-talk, actually. It's like having a mantra, isn't it, I guess, to some people. But for me to pray and to offload how I really feel, no bars held, God. You know me, so I'm going to tell you exactly how it is, because this is how I'm feeling. And I'm looking for a tree, because that's how bad I feel. I just want to escape the shame of a police officer being sacked. That was so shameful. And thankfully, you know, there was a gracious decision made, and I ended my career, and I drew a pension, and I left on good terms. But there are all sorts of avenues that are tempting to go down. And part of being emotionally intelligent, I think, is having somebody that can empathize and relate to where you are. I'm on about a friend that could really, really understand and really see. Unfortunately, mine lived in Cambridge, my really close friend that's like a brother. And although he was great, sometimes you need to be able to say, can I come around to yours in 5 minutes?
Yeah, you need someone that you can interface with. And, you know, it's so interesting to, well, firstly, thank you for sharing that. And man, like what a trifecta of just weight and heaviness to experience. And I guess in retrospect, anyone could go, oh, well, that would have been a great moment for self-awareness to not even have gone out on the job, right? Yeah. But everyone's dam can break. And I think you get a complete pass for self-awareness not being there, not being there when all that was going on, because, everyone has their limits. And sure, it might have been better if you didn't go to work, but at the end of the day, we're all just doing the best we can, right, in the moment. And self-aware, emotional intelligence often is reactive at times. It's learning from things said and done that, okay, if I could do that differently going forward, how am I going to do it differently? But when life gets that heavy, it's important to have community and support and friends and mates that can lift you up and hold you up when you can't hold yourself up, right?
Yeah, and I think, thank you for saying that. I think that my emotional intelligence behaviors came out more after the incident to manage the way I was feeling. Because it's not just as a man, I guess women feel the same. But when that fight with that disorder was going off, I controlled it from the control room. So I was asking about resourcing, doing the right thing, having that strategic overview, but they were being overrun. And sometimes you have to have visible leadership.
Yeah.
And I'd left it, but I needed to be there. They call it in the UK, when you put your brown gloves on, the inspector has brown gloves. It means you're going out to do the business. You've you've done all the strategic stuff, but now it's all hands to the pump. And even still, some might have said, no, I'd have still stayed. But one of my gifts that I was given when I left the police, this is the way my people saw me. It's a frame. It says, true leader, great friend. And, you know, I still see a lot of my people because we had a relationship. They knew I was the boss, but we had a relationship, and it was a trust relationship, and we went through some deep stuff together. So it's that judgment call. I'm not sure there would have ever been a good time because of what was happening in my personal life. But one thing I do know is, even if the stuff, the strategies that you practice, you know, talent smart, do some great strategies for your self-management, your self-awareness, your social awareness, and your relationship building. Excuse me, just using those just kept the edge off, just kept my head above water a little bit in terms of how I dealt with people.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, Kevin, mate, you've lived a life, mate. It's quite an array of experiences, and it's amazing to hear your story, because your experiences create great perspective for me and anyone who hasn't served, whether in the military or served in law enforcement, to have some empathy for, you know, for those that do put their lives on the line, the incredible degrees of stress that those who serve go through, and also both, and the importance that all of these men and women that are out there in uniform are getting access to the right resources, support, and training that they need to be able to handle those situations in an emotionally intelligent way. Which leads to my final question for you, which is, in your capacity right now, which is working with law enforcement, working with military all across Europe to bring in emotional intelligence training to them, say you get to wave a magic wand and your mission for this phase of life has been achieved. What does the world look like, you having achieved that mission?
It's interesting, because to answer your question, there was a really good experiment, social experiment, that was done in the UK. It's fascinating, Brandon. It was a group of men and women, two groups of men and women, and they were both being trained and led for a period, I think it was about 6 weeks, training for an obstacle race, so a military, really tough assault course. The one group was soldiers, command and control, tough it up, get on with it, bah! shouted in their faces like that. The other group was run by a leadership coach that was a civilian, okay? And it was very much, okay, folks, has anybody got any ideas of the best way to do this? What's the best way to get over the wall? Okay, love what you're saying, Jill. What about you, John? Yeah, okay, well, how about if we incorporate John and Jill's ideas? Are we all happy with that? Yeah, great. Okay, let's do it. Come on, then. At the end, they do the final episode is they have the race, the obstacle race. And you can see that the soldiers, having that really harsh approach, lack of trust, robotic, no creativity, no psychological safety, yeah, fearful, compared to creative, inclusive, driven, challenged, and encouraged. And have a guess who won? By a long way. It was the leadership coach.
Wow.
And that there was high degrees of emotional intelligence there. So in answer to your question, using that as an illustration, a great place would be where leaders are seen as people that create an environment where people can grow and flourish, have an opinion when it's appropriate, and are valued. But also, because we can't get away from the fact that the Army is a disciplined organization and the police, but also that the followers understand the environment and the landscape and manage their own emotions and their own awareness and the social awareness too, to understand the environment. And a classic was in 2011, I was managing a large unit of police officers in the national UK riots. It was horrendous. And I said to my people before we went out, I'm usually really, really laid back and calm. I said, but we've never gone into this before. We're about to go into really hostile territory. And because of that, I'm going to be quite transactional. There aren't going to be any pleases or thank yous. It's going to be you there. I might even have to grab you. And so it's, and they knew that. They said, no, boss, we absolutely understand. And when we finished and we had that debrief, I said, I'm so sorry that I was so shouty. And they just went, no, we got it. We're all home. We're all safe. And we're happy for that.
Yeah.
So it's understanding the environment and also helping our leaders out that are emotionally intelligent by allowing them to exercise all of their responsibilities and helping them flourish in their emotional intelligence. As followers, we can help them. And I think if we get that, because the police is a hard nut to crack in the UK, it's not.
Yeah.
Although I'm making ground, the UK police are the slowest to come on board, I have to say, with what we're offering. But there's some research that shows an ingrained, embedded culture is hard to change. But once it does change, it changes for the better, and that new culture embeds as much as the old one did. So hopefully we're going to get to a place where emotional intelligence is part of the selection criteria as an indicator, but that also all new recruits have it, specialist units that are at high-risk situations because that's where it works most effectively, and that emotional intelligence is actually seen as the DNA of the armed forces and the police.
Wow. Beautiful, mate. Beautiful. You're working towards that. You're one of those that is doing the walking and not just the talking. So I appreciate the work that you're doing and the ripple that that's going to have on the lives of others. So Kevin, it's been a pleasure speaking with you today.
Great. Thank you very much. And just before you go, there's a lot of my life that's being written in a book of memoirs, and it's called Getting Into the Boat. But I'll let you know, Brandon, when it comes out, and maybe we can talk again.
We'll have you on. Fantastic. All right, Kevin, thanks, mate. Speak soon.
Thank you.
This has been another episode of the Mankind Podcast, produced in association with the Mankind Project USA. We have been your hosts, Boyson Hodgson, and myself, Brandon Clift, and we want to thank our guests for joining us today and imparting their wisdom from their experiences in this amazing journey called life. If you want to find out more about today's guests and support them in their mission, you can find links to them in the show notes. Now, if you have found gold and insights that you believe could benefit your loved ones and those you care about, be sure to share it with them. And of course, we are always grateful for a rating and review of the show on iTunes. Now, above all else, we've got to thank you, the listener, because through your attention and your support, you have made it possible for us to let men all over the world know that they are not alone and that there is more than one way to be a man. And if something in this episode has touched you, then perhaps it is the call to action to get involved in men's work. With live trainings happening constantly and in-person trainings happening all over the world, the Mankind Project definitely has something for you. Now, if you've enjoyed the music in this episode and all of our episodes, be sure to check out Jim Donovan and the Sun King Warriors. I have links to them in the show notes. And lastly, just know, what it means to me to be a man is completely different than what it means for you. That is the beauty of this journey. So if you are looking for guidance, support, and community as you begin to unpack and dive deeper into your men's work journey, then you know where to find us. Same place, same time, next week. Lots of love. We'll see you then.